Does man, that marvel of the universe, that glorious paradox who sent me to the stars, still make war against his brother?
And welcome to Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me as always is Jason.
Hello, everybody.
And today is the start of a series we're going to do. We're not going to fool ourselves and pretend that we can cram this all into one episode or two episodes. We're going to just see how many we can get out of this. We're going to milk this a little bit, just like the original franchise did. And of course, I'm talking about Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Which was the phenom, and really, I think, the science fiction blockbuster for the early to middle 1970s.
Absolutely. And I just want to say one thing right off the bat. For those of you out there that are making fun of us going, yeah, about time you guys woke up and realized that you talk so much that you can split things up into two or three parts. You're right. You're absolutely right.
Is anyone saying that?
Yeah, I can hear Steve Johnson over in Ames, Iowa, saying it right now.
Is that the same Steve Johnson who used to do special effects in movies?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, wow.
You think we're not listening, Steve, but you're absolutely right. However, there are those other guys out there, sort of like us, that it would take longer for them to realize that they could milk things for two or three shows. We came to the realization in our own good time. Secondly, that was a great intro regarding Planet of the Apes, and there's so much more to say, but the way you just described it as the phenom and the franchise in the early 70s, what that always brings me to immediately as an association or whatever is every time you start – anyone talks about – the merchandising story of Star Wars, Planet of the Apes is always referenced as when they say, you know, keep in mind that there hadn't really been a science fiction franchise before Star Wars that had really done much in the way of merchandise, except for, oh, let's say maybe Planet of the Apes, and that wasn't even that phenomenal. And that you know, guys like Lucas and Alan Ladd Jr. and the the Lucasfilm, you know, people, they always, you know, make that reference regarding Planet of the Apes. But in hindsight, when you look back on it, it really was a bonanza. And we'll get to all of that and how it happened, you know, after the talking about the making of the movies. But I think it really – and you'll know better than me because you collect a lot of this stuff. But it really was a – you know, compared to Star Wars, of course, nothing was on the frickin' radar.
Well, yeah, but I can tell you the exact difference, because not only do I collect Planet of the Apes stuff, which I do, but I collect toy industry insider stuff. So I have a run of magazines that were, you know, sent to toy and hobby shops that from the early 70s to the early 80s. And so you can almost watch it happen. And the difference between Star Wars and Apes is Star Wars, there was merchandising from the get-go. Apes, it took a long time for somebody to realize, hey, kids like this.
Yeah, it's almost – I think you can draw a lot of parallels with Star Trek and the second life that these things sort of had. So maybe by getting there, we start with – that first motion picture.
Absolutely. I think we could almost dwell. The first one is just worth a whole episode unto itself for its impact, even though you and I were too young, obviously, to have seen it in the theater at the time, and I didn't exist, I don't believe you did either.
I did not see Apes in the theater until I had moved to Los Angeles, and I made a habit of going to the New Beverly Cinema on Beverly Boulevard.
Did you sit next to Patton Oswalt a lot?
For double features. You know, it's funny. I met him there a couple of times way back.
He wrote a whole book about that.
Oh, he did? About meeting
him? Yeah, Silver Screen. Not about meeting you. About going to the New Beverly almost obsessive compulsively. It's a really good book.
Yeah, because I'll tell you, the New Beverly, I mean, for $5,
yeah,
you got a double feature. It was filled with movie geeks. So, you know, during the breaks, you could, you know, chit-chat. They had kosher hot dogs. They may still do, but they had these kosher hot dogs.
Like a Nathan's?
Yeah, and they were so good. You do two hot dogs, a beverage, and a popcorn, and you're good for the night. Let me tell you a quick little sideline as we're talking about the New Beverly.
Sideline here?
Have we talked about the – have we mentioned the topic yet?
Yeah, I think it's hot dogs.
Just a real quick, cool New Beverly story, and I could do a whole episode on my adventures at the New Beverly. For some
– I'd be very silent during that one.
I know. I'm sorry. For some roundabout reason – a guy that I knew, it's a long story, but I became friends with a guy named Sadig El Fadil, who is now
Doctor from Star Trek.
Yeah, he's now Alexander Sadig. Haven't seen him in years, but we became buddies. I ended up on Star Trek. I ended up on a couple episodes of Star Trek. and kissed what's her name? She was an alien with stuff on her face.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah.
Anyway, he is Malcolm McDowell's nephew.
Neat.
In real life. And so, however this was arranged, Malcolm McDowell was going to be at a screening at the New Beverly of A Clockwork Orange. So when the screening was done, he was going to get up, take the microphone. You know, I had been to a few of these. But this one, I sat next to Malcolm McDowell throughout Clockwork Orange, which was awesome. But the two things I remember distinctly about it, one was him turning to me, mentioning his haircut in Clockwork Orange, and he turned to me and said, "The Beatles have got a lot to answer for, don't they?" And the other thing that killed me was, because you know Dave Prowse? I don't know if have you ever seen Clockwork Orange? I'm assuming.
Yeah, many, many times, yeah.
Do you know the bit where Dave Prowse shows up?
Yeah, he's the guy who lifts, what's his name there, Patrick McGee around.
And he just kind of, he's watching the film, and he just ever so gently sort of gestures toward the screen with his index finger and turns to me and says, "That's Darth Vader." And that is it. That was the two memories I have of Clockwork Orange at the New Beverly.
That's
the only time I ever saw Apes in the theater. And as another quick little sidebar, I was kind of upset about it. I remember being upset at the screening because people were in hysterics from the opening frame to the end. It became this camp classic that the ultra hipster, in on the joke crowd at the New Beverly, it was like a piss take for 2 hours.
Oh, I hate that.
And I
was
ready to get up and leave. And I was like, it ain't that funny, man. You know, I mean, some of the Heston stuff, some of the square jawed earnest.
Oh, yeah, it's burned itself into pop culture. So therefore, you know, it's come across like that. But
yeah.
If you pay to see a movie, like I once paid to see Plan 9 at the Bloor Cinema in Toronto, and there was this obnoxious woman in front of me trying to do MST3K. And it's like, first of all, you're not funny. Second of all, this movie doesn't need you.
Right.
This movie does not need you.
It does
Stop
fine
it.
On its own.
Yeah, and I'll enjoy it without, you know, secretary commentary. Thank you very much.
Right.
You
know?
But
funny.
Yeah, you could just, there was a group of people and you could tell she was the wacky friend.
Yeah,
she
I mean
was
this
getting
was,
a little over rambunctious, you know.
This was really like every time Heston opened his mouth, the theater just erupted in hysterics.
Yeah, and it's not it doesn't have that. In fact, I think it's a really I think it's still a really great movie.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's
and it, you know there's some camp to it. Now, my personal take on this movie is kind of funny.
Mm.
I saw it last.
Explain that statement.
As a kid, I somehow managed to stumble through the cartoon. I was just on the tail end of that, right? I was four when it kind of all ended.
Wait, so, you're telling me that you got to the cartoon and...
I started on the cartoon, and, really? And we'll go into the cartoon later. And then I saw some of the movies, then they brought out the TV movies of the TV series. Remember, they put two episodes together and syndicated those?
No, I do not. In fact...
What?
In fact, I only have a vague recollection of the animated series as it aired. I do have recollection of the live-action series.
That's what I mean. They took the live-action series and made them into syndicated TV movies. You never saw those?
Nope. I have no idea until you just said it now.
I worked kind of backwards. And actually, I was the kid in the era of Star Wars trying, like, buying my friend's Planet of the Apes trading cards. Like, I was into it. I was almost a hipster kid because I really liked it and was fascinated by it, but I just sort of missed it.
Now, tell me...
I had some toys, but...
Let's go back. We don't need to go into like the numerous meetings over at Fox and how this thing got off the ground and everything. For those that have no clue what the frick we're talking about, it was a novel by Pierre Boulez, I believe his name.
Yeah, the Planète des Singes.
He was a French dude. Planète
des Singes. Have you ever read it?
I have never read it. No.
It's a bit on the along the lines of Animal Farm. In the fact that it's not a straight adventure, so to speak, as it is trying to be like an allegory for society.
Yeah,
and it's very, very different, and it does have a twist ending.
It does, and it's different than the film. My understanding was that the book made the society, the ape society, much more technologically advanced.
They were almost futuristic
than they were in the film, and that was changed, you know, for budget considerations and other things. But which kills me. You're talking about this allegory, and it's like, even as a kid, you watch 5 minutes of this thing, and you go, "Oh, I know what they're saying there." You know, civil rights and this and that. And which kills me, if you look at some of the documentaries, and what's his name, the producer's kid. It kills me because it's so cliche. Number one, he's the head of the studio's son,
Daryl Zanuck.
Zanuck, which the
I love him. He
literally goes, "Yeah, I didn't see any kind of I wasn't aware of any sort of like really you didn't see any parallels." In the late 60s, with what was going on with the civil rights movement and youth culture and the establishment in Vietnam, you didn't see any of that?
Well, the first movie's way more subtle than some of the sequels in that. I will say the first one can be taken on its own. Then you get, you know, you got the hippies in part two.
Right.
Part four is definitely talking about civil unrest.
Yeah, just a bit.
Just a bit. But yeah, maybe he's just, hopefully he's just talking about part one, which,
yeah, he was talking,
you know,
about part
one. They're crafting a world and there's a lot going on. So yeah, I can kind of see that. And you can take it just for itself. You know, a friend of mine once said, we were talking about, remember George Romero made Land of the Dead?
Yes, I do.
And Land of the Dead had a little bit of a heavy-handed message.
Which
and
was?
I think he wasn't a fan of Bush's America.
Right.
And my friend said, you know, the problem I have with that is that someone had to tell me the allegory of Dawn of the Dead. Because I could just enjoy it at a movie on its own. This one, the message.
You mean the shopping mall culture? And
yeah, yeah. He didn't catch that. Mm. And he said, this one, you know, it was hitting me on the head, and I hate being hit on the head with things. And I can kind of understand and relate to what he's trying to say. Is you don't want the message to be too strong, but I think in Apes it's very subtle, and there's a lot of cleverness to it.
Yes, there are, and The other thing I wanted to say that was so cliche about the executive producer, who is the son of the head of the network, it's like the head of the network goes, "Here, kid. Here's a couple bucks. Go make a movie. Do whatever."
Well, no, I think he was actually president at the time.
Yes. And,
yeah, and then his dad fired him later.
The other thing, yeah, exactly. But the other thing that killed me that's just so cliche, it's like Nova was his girlfriend.
Oh, yeah. And she's also in a,
in a
Batman
Monkeys
episode. Well, I think she's probably in a Monkeys. She's in a Batman episode. She plays a cheerleader.
Mm.
And I think she's in the original. Now, in order, they went through a lot of pitching of this thing.
Right.
And Arthur P. Jacobs got Heston on board early. And
that's
Heston,
right.
And they make this, and you can look it up on YouTube if you haven't seen it. I hope you've seen it. This
The makeup test. And
the early makeup testing.
Well, you got Edward G. Robinson, who was going to be
Zaius. Yes,
but who was was it Brolin?
It was James Brolin as Cornelius.
James Brolin.
And Linda Harrison is Zira.
That's right.
And their makeups, you know, the makeups kind of remind me of Twilight Zone.
Yes.
Totally. Episodes where they're, you know, they're very crude.
Oh, and we got to get to that too, because
Of course, yeah, we will. But did you know, this is interesting too. So that scene gets filmed when Chambers is working on the apes' makeup.
Mm-hmm.
One of the early versions of it ends up on a Lost in Space. There's an episode, and I learned this from Starlog Magazine, callback, that there's an episode where they get put in prison. Don and Guy Williams get put in space prison or something, and of course they're wearing the stripes, you know. And they escape with one of the Khans, and the Khan is in full Planet of the Apes makeup.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah,
I did not know that. Well, we're going to get to the Twilight Zone connection in a moment. You just said some Linda Harrison's. Okay, quick question, quick pop quiz then. Linda Harrison, is she in the top 5 or top 10 sexiest 60s genre chicks of all time? Top 5, top 10?
I haven't actually, you know,
top
I didn't
20?
Do my homework. Well, yeah, I would say possibly top 10.
Top 10?
Yeah.
She's right up there, I think.
Yeah.
And best of all, she doesn't speak.
Oh, that's not.
Oh, come on. I'm sorry. Is it too soon? Is it too soon to make Linda Harrison jokes?
Isn't she still alive?
She's
right?
still alive, and she still can't speak.
I met her. I got her autograph.
I think you're thinking of Carolyn Monroe. No, I'm kidding.
No, I actually did meet Linda Harrison.
I'm kidding. The next question is, was there any part of you that had a tiny crush on Zira?
No.
Not a bit? I had a little something, because I think I either Starlog or one of those things, I saw what the actress looked like and I realized who it was, and then I saw Streetcar once on TV when I was just a little kid, and I thought, well, she's actually pretty cute, and then
she projects cool mom to me.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
Which isn't. Oh, I see. Oh, okay. I didn't know where you were going with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And yeah, the way she smiled. She's got that little squinty thing with the eyes when she smiles that made her pretty cute. But it also started, I think Apes started my – I was never a Heston fan, never as a kid. I never saw him as this heroic, you know, like, oh, I can't wait for the – I mean, we watched all the Heston movies, but I was never like, oh, yeah, Heston's the guy. But
you and I had very different opinions of that. I thought he ruled.
Well, we got to get to that because it's an extraordinary vehicle all around for this leading man. But what I want to say as another sidebar, started my, you know, non-sexual man crush on Roddy McDowall. Planet of the Apes. And it became like I wanted to see everything Roddy McDowall did. Like if his name was attached to something, I was there. Like there was just something.
We shared that. He also did a lot of fun projects.
Yeah, like, totally.
I swear, every 70s sci-fi show, he plays a mad scientist.
Yep.
And B, often with androids. A Man yes. Called Sloan, Fantastic Journey. Like it's kind of weird. But yeah, If Unless Roddy McDowell's in it.
His Frenchman in Tales of the Gold Monkey.
Yeah, he wasn't the original Lucky Pierre, was he?
He was not. The original was,
Clive Revell.
Clive Revell.
Yeah.
Yeah, who was another genre face.
And he was a bad guy twice on A Man Called Sloane. Well, okay, we're really going...
We're going deep undercover here. And you were like the Man Called Sloane efficient. You are the...
Somebody's got to be.
Somebody's got to be. Oh, by the way, we got to talk about a merchandise thing off air. Remind me that that just occurred to me that I need to talk to you about. So
okay,
meet me after the show.
Meet you by the bike racks?
Yeah, meet me by the bike racks after the show.
Okay.
Okay, so let's talk about this, though. The more you see apes, the more I see it, and as I've gotten older, it is an incredibly... It's first off, it's a very unlikable leading character. He's a very unlikable character.
He is the essential, and this was the start of it, but late 60s, early 70s, we got the anti-hero big time. You know, you got the Billy Jacks and the Easy Riders, and here we go with a leading man who hates humanity.
Yeah, and so he's very unlikable. He And this is not a dig on Heston at all. Like it's easy to trash, you know, what he did. Let's not forget, too, that Heston was – people – you know, ever since that documentary when Michael Moore, you know what's the word I'm looking for? Not sabotaged, but
– ambushed him. Sandbagged him.
Ambushed him.
Yeah.
People have kind of put him into a box. But let's not forget, this is a guy that marched on Washington for civil rights.
Yeah, no, you know, there's much more to him than... And his later years were not, you know, he didn't do his best work.
So when you're looking at this is to choose to do this, I mean, he probably saw potential in this thing as maybe a big motion picture or whatever, but in choosing to do it... You know, it's a very unlikable character. It's a very vulnerable character. And honestly, he gets the shit beat out of him in this movie.
Oh, yeah. And he really did get the crap beat out of him.
Yes, he
did.
He got
pneumonia. This was a grueling part for him. You know what's funny, though, is every interview I've ever read with somebody I've read two interviews. One was with Linda Harrison. The other is with... the young guy in the Omega Man. I can't remember his name right now.
Not the guy. I always get him mixed up with Link from the Mod Squad.
No, not the white guy. The Dutch. He plays Dutch. Oh, give me a second.
It's not Don Stroud.
It's Paul Coslow.
Oh, Coslow.
Both of them said, you know, how's it to work with Heston? And, and both of them kind of made this comment of... he was okay when he was around, meaning like Heston filmed his scenes and you filmed your scenes.
Oh, is that how it went?
Paul Coslow's like, I filmed all my scenes talking to a mop, right? Because Heston went home.
That's disappointing. That's too bad. Well, let's also point out, and not that I'm an aficionado of male nudity in films, but the butt shots. You know, I can tell you that Connery gave a butt shot in The Man Who Would Be King. I can tell you that, you know, so-and-so did. Or I can tell you that Michael Caine never did. You know what I mean? Like those weird things where like – and this is back in the day when not only was on-screen nudity in a mainstream feature very, very rare, male on-screen nudity was almost unheard of. And there's a very clear butt shot of Charlton Heston. I mean, I don't think I'm overstressing this. It had to be kind of shocking at the time for a leading man like that was so well known to cross over to do something like that. You know what I mean? It had to be kind of shocking. And this was also...
I think it was important to that movie, though, because it kind of made them the animals.
I remember it making me so uncomfortable as a kid. So much of the movie, much as I liked the apes stuff, so much of that first movie, because your leading man your hero is so vulnerable throughout this whole thing and really gets the tar kicked out of him. That particular scene, you know, they're making fun of him. Like, they strip him down to nothing. And they're making fun of his smell, and they're like looking at the ground, and it's like the audience kind of chuckles, and he's kind of embarrassed and tries to kind of cover himself up. And it's a really awful thing to do to your hero, your leading character.
The one film that always reminds me of that too is one that came out around the same time, The Naked Prey.
Oh my God, is that the Richard Harris one?
No, it's Cornel Wilde.
Cornel Wilde. And
yeah.
Oh, that's brutal. That is a brutal film.
And it's very, very similar to, like, even the poster kind of, like, every time I see the poster for The Naked Prey, I think, oh, Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
And then I realize, no, it's a different bearded man running in a, you know, in a loincloth.
What's the Richard Harris? Is there A Man Called Horse?
A Man Called Horse, yeah.
Where he gets strung up by his skin?
Yeah.
Holy
God,
that's
another trend there.
Yeah, we'll do our Richard Harris episode. We'll cover A Man Called Sloan, a horse. So here's the goofy thing. Like, I mean, if you were to show Planet of the Apes to someone for the first time, 1969's Planet of the Apes, sit down, you know, an 18-year-old or a 30-year-old or whatever, the credits roll and you're not. It's not like the end of Star Wars where you're like, yeah, what's next? You know, it's a bleak movie. It's a hell of a ride for your leading character to go on. And there's no way, if we talk about the ending, if you're listening to this episode and you haven't seen Planet of the Apes and you don't know about the frickin' people that have never seen the movie have to know about the frickin' ending at this point.
Well, yeah, if you've ever seen a Family Guy or a Simpsons or...
It's one of the single most... It's got to be top five most memorable / shocking / groundbreaking, mind-blowing endings in the history of cinema.
Yeah.
Once seen, never forgotten. And my understanding, and here we come back to Twilight Zone, one of my heroes, Rod Serling... This is after Twilight Zone had its run. So Twilight Zone wrapped up in 1964. He did some writing assignments, wrote some more screenplays, I think, and he bopped around the studios a bit. I forget exactly how Apes fell into his lap, but I think he was familiar with the book before it came to him. But that particular element, the ending, the shock twist ending, was Rod Serling's. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but that's...
No, that's... It's largely... It's not 100%... From what I remember, it's not 100% known whose fingerprints or what and what was left. But it is largely believed of everything that he wrote, that's what was kept in.
That's my understanding, is that by the time... Ironically... As famous as he was and as brilliant a writer as he was, they rejected the bulk of his script.
I believe his script, though, and again, someone can correct me or somebody who's a little fresher on this, because it's been a while.
Yeah.
I believe his script was based on the novel more, and it had helicopters and you know, this ape society.
Yeah, he went...
So
he went
I think the rewrites were... more or less based on budgetary things.
Right. And the one element I think of his that was kept in subsequent drafts, because I think there were two or three drafts after his, was that ending.
Yeah.
And this was also, I mean, you know, the ratings system was different back in 69, but I believe this was a PG.
I think it was G.
Was it G?
Yeah. I remember reading that going, I'm misreading that, right? Like, but yeah, it was a different time.
I think you could be right. And it was, I mean, there's nudity, there's incredible violence.
Yeah.
There's swearing, which I don't even think there was supposed to be swearing in a G picture. I don't think that was...
Well, there isn't a ton of swearing, but yeah.
But again, if it's a G, and so, you know, it's it's a pretty bleak movie overall.
It really started the downer trend of science fiction, where everything kind of ended with this, you know, off-putting, you know, weird ending.
You don't know if the hero is gonna make it out. And the parallels or the comparisons to Star Wars don't end there with the merchandising thing, because it was, again, you know, by the time you got to Star Wars, one of the things that's a universal that keeps coming back and keeps coming back in every interview and to this day, every time Lucas sits down to talk about it, was I was trying to not only recycle these things that I loved and grew up with to make a popcorn picture, but to make something fun where the good guys wore white and the bad guys wore black, or, you know, so to speak. But to bring adventure and fun back, because things had gotten so bleak between the heroes that were on television and even things like the Apes movies and the sci-fi stuff that was out there. It was pretty frickin' bleak.
Well, between 2001 and Planet of the Apes,
yeah,
things got really kind of and we covered this in an episode, but things got a little uncommercial, I guess.
Oh yeah.
And what Lucas is trying to say is, hey, I grew up liking Flash Gordon.
Right.
Where is the Flash Gordon in this world? And you know, so you're right. They are oddly correct. They are oddly connected. And he made space cool again.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And yeah. It's really kind of, you know, wild when you look back on it, or I think it is when you do look back on Apes. That first one, it was a huge success. I mean, it did really well.
And what's really, I find really funny is that Heston wanted nothing to do with it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a driving force behind the original.
Yep, and he was like, thank you very much, I'm done.
Yeah. And he was a big frickin' name. His name being attached to anything, I think, helped get it made, and it helped attach other names to it. You know, I mean, Roddy McDowall was a well-known actor, but, you know, he was a child actor. And, you know, I think this is one of the first things where he sort of made that transition from, you know, Lassie to more adult fare.
As I recall, he had to go back to stage and kind of earn his chops as an actor. And he spent a great deal of time doing that. And yeah, Apes was definitely, well, it definitely took his career up again.
Oh, yeah. So you had Roddy McDowall as Cornelius. You had Kim Hunter as Zira. Edward G. Robinson was going to play Dr. Zaius, but
he couldn't handle the makeup.
Couldn't handle the makeup. So who?
But then Heston and Robinson were in Soylent Green.
That's right.
Always, yeah.
And as we know, Soylent Green is people.
Thanks a lot.
Wait a second. So who played Zaius?
I want to say Booth Coleman, but that's the TV Zaius. It's Samantha's dad from Bewitched, who is Maurice Evans.
Maurice Evans.
And that's why the orangutan is named Maurice in the new Planet of the Apes film.
I think one of the coolest stories told in one of the documentaries about the making of Apes, you know, the makeup at the time, I think it won an Oscar, that makeup, right?
Special Oscar? John Chambers, yeah.
Extraordinary makeup at the time. And wasn't he the character in Argo? Wasn't he the guy, John Goodman character?
John Goodman. And they couldn't have found a better actor to play him than John Goodman.
Oh, that is great.
Yeah.
But Kim Hunter, somebody was talking about when they would break for lunch.
Yeah, they all ate. Yeah. The category.
The all sat together. The chimps all sat together. And the gorillas all sat together. They just kind of congregated just because of, you know, wearing the same kind of makeup. And it was an extensive makeup that you couldn't just take it off in between, you know, meals or whatever.
What killed me about this movie was, instead, the apes were forced down to a primitive society to make the film more palatable to the budget, and so they then create this incredible world. You know, these buildings are so neatly done.
Right.
Like the Ape City, I know it's filmed on the back lot, and it was probably filmed on a budget, but it's really well done.
Oh, yeah. And also, let's talk about the budget. Let's talk about the director's on the tip of my tongue. Who is the director of this?
Get him off. You know, now I can't think of it because you said so.
It's on the tip of my tongue. But you must know who did the music. James Whitmore. Who did the dance?
James Whitmore.
No. Who did the
First of all, it was directed by Franklin J. Schaffner.
All right, Franklin Schaffner.
And Jerry Goldsmith.
Jerry Goldsmith.
The very very avant-garde
weird
score.
I mean, yeah. It's like boop 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 boop.
Well, and there's sounds in there that sound like monkeys, and you know, like they did this brilliant thing. And to be perfectly honest with you, I must reference the cornfield music every time we have a group of children in the house. You know,
explain, please.
Well, because that's such a chaotic, and, you know, and my wife and I are both fans of Planet of the Apes, probably me more than her, but so if I do that, she gets where I'm going with that.
How about, speaking of the cornfield stuff, and we've got loads to get to because there's so much to the Apes. I mean, the Apes, it is the definition of a franchise. It has permeated, you know, film, television, animation, merchandise, etc.
There's so much to go into. I think we could almost do a whole Apes merchandising show.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Remakes slash reimaginings. And the two most recent, because the names are so convoluted, I don't remember what they're called. But it's like Rise of and Beneath the Next Day of or whatever.
Life, Liberty, and Pursuit on the Planet of the Apes.
Right. But the first one, one of the single coolest, most spine-tingling jump out of your seat for me moments in the first one, the Andy Serkis first one, was the when you I forget how it goes, but it's on the bridge. It's on the Golden Gate Bridge. And we've seen horses, we've seen apes, we haven't made the connection, we haven't seen them together. And then all of a sudden it happens in such an organic way that you go, oh, yeah, there it is, shit. Yeah. You know? And it's like, you see the horse and then all of a sudden Caesar pops upright or something, like he's kind of hanging on the side and then all of a sudden he's astride.
It's almost impossible to remake this film because you can't do it better.
Yes.
You can't shock the audience the way you once did.
Right.
So honestly, I mean, up until that first film came out, Dawn, I believe it was called.
Yes, Dawn.
Or Rise. You know, I always get them mixed up. I know we've done this before. I didn't think you could remake Planet of the Apes. I really didn't think it was doable or possible.
Right.
Without it, you know, being accepted, like being treated like it's campy, which I despise.
Right.
Not that I take it super seriously, but I don't want to watch a campy remake of something. Right. And
that's beyond the multitude of problems that the Tim Burton one had.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
But you just hit it. Like that is one of it.
Yeah.
Beyond the other shitty aspects, from the get-go, it's the tongue is firmly in cheek, and it's pointing out the silliness, if you want to get to it, or the goofiness of the original. I mean, look, you know, see, I have we've never really discussed Mystery Science Theater too much. I remember Mystery Science Theater when it was a local show in the Twin Cities, like Channel 23, when Joel was doing it, you know, Channel 23. Loved the notion of it. I still do. Something happened where it went from making fun of bad movies, which we can all do, you know, sitting at home, and, you know, we've all done it, you know, for years, but it crossed over into everything, you know, where I think it might have been the movie. When the movie was doing a piss take on This Island Earth, And then it becomes like, well, you know, now you're just now everything. I mean, you can sit and do it with the Godfather if you want. It's no longer. I mean, it doesn't make anything. And I've worked with both Joel and Mike, and I worked with Mike on a show back in the Twin Cities. I went back to the Twin Cities from here to work on this thing, and he's great. He's a great guy, and we hit it off immediately. But nothing is precious to him. You know, everything is sort of rippable, and I get that. But it kind of like it diminishes everything after a while. You know, and Apes, it's exactly what happened sitting in that theater at the New Beverly watching Apes, you know, for the first time in the theater, where every line, you know, if you can dissect anything that way and poke the holes in it.
Oh, sure. I mean, and that's you could probably do that with Requiem for a Dream, but
right. Well,
and you know, I kind of share that. Yeah. Nothing is terribly sacred to me either. I grew up in a household where, you know, if I was watching something and my mom would walk by and point out that was a styrofoam rock,
right.
Or, you know, just that's the household. So I kind of get that. Would I watch a riff of The Godfather? No, I would rather watch a riff of a grade school short. You know, something
right.
you know, an educational short. So yeah, you're right. I know what you're trying to say.
I say where, like, you know, you can, you know, eventually you can. It's the problem with the internet in general,
yeah.
Where it's like, you know, I mean, the first thing that sort of comes to mind, the more recent, is Guardians of the Galaxy, where, I mean, I love this movie. I think I saw it twice when it came out. Since having it on DVD, I think I've seen it like four times. I just love it. I just love the way it's put together and the neat way it's sort of tied up with a string, you know. And then suddenly 2 months go by and you see articles online that say everything that's wrong with Guardians of the Galaxy.
But, you know, everybody needs clickbait these days.
Right.
Yeah, so we pick everything apart.
Yeah,
so.
And it's like, well, shit, man, like... Why do you got to do that? Why does everything?
Well, the thing to do though is just don't bother looking at it, you know.
Oh yeah, I agree. But it's like it. I don't know what it is. If it's a feeling of superiority that people need to have, or you know, say, well, nothing is special anymore. I don't know what it is, but it's we're living in a cult.
I read an article. I clicked on an article the other day. It was like the top three worst Batman. And these people had like, I was expecting Clooney and maybe Val Kilmer,
right?
But I forget. I think Christian Bale was number one.
Jeez.
And they're saying we all know every Christian Bale movie was crap, and it's like, do we? Do we all know that?
Really?
Like, yeah, I couldn't believe it.
Wait, with enough hindsight, I'd say it. They.
I, you know, just because you can write something on the internet. Like, and I'm guilty of it as well. Like, I write these top 10 lists on Plaid Stallions, and people will go, I don't agree with this, and it's like, well, I'm no one.
Right.
I'm a breezy Friday afternoon distraction for 10
Yeah,
minutes.
And it's just, I mean, the stuff that you're talking about or that you're writing is just supposed to get conversations going. If you're saying these are the 10, you know, grooviest yeah. or goofiest or most fun, you're also not in the business of going... And these 10 are the biggest pieces of shit or whatever. You know, it's like...
Yeah, well, and I also fail to see where I have my notary official seal here. Like, you know, it's just, you know, when I used to write at Topless Robot, I would write just goofy distraction lists. And people, I remember some of the weirdest fights would erupt. And I'd think, I didn't think anyone cared this much about Sesame Street merchandise. You know? Okay, well, have a good day, everybody.
That's what you think.
Yeah. Well, I got shown. But we should get back to where were we?
Yeah,
with
would
Apes?
You please stop and just get back to the time?
I want to just tell a little bit of an ape story because I was getting it kind of comes to a point. I had not seen the entire film when I was about 16.
Okay.
I'd always catch bits and pieces of it. It's a bit like Jaws. I've seen Jaws probably. Like a puzzle, you know, a dozen times.
Wait.
I have seen Jaws start to finish.
Okay,
yes,
all right.
But I often come in the middle of Jaws and watch it and remark, how come I never watched this start to finish? Planet of the Apes, I had never seen the whole thing.
Hmm.
And I was 16 or 17, and I was out yard sailing with a friend of mine.
I'm going to stop you right there. What a sentence. That's such a great sentence. I was out yard sailing with a buddy of mine.
Yeah, well, I used to hang out with this guy, and we'd go yard sailing in Toronto all day.
Awesome.
And I was actually looking for Planet of the Apes merchandise. So I remembered that the Rochester station was playing Planet of the Apes. So I called home in a panic and got my probably not too happy mom. And, you know, Planet of the Apes 2:30. Can you get, I didn't want my...
Wait, so would you put a blank VHS?
I had a blank tape in there, but I wanted to make sure my sister, who was home at the time, didn't screw it up. So
Stayed away from it?
Yeah, I get home at about 3 o'clock, and my sister's watching it, and she goes, "We're taping your stupid movie." And I'm super excited. I don't watch it then because I want to see it start to finish.
Right?
I kid you not. I wish I still had this. I turn it on at the start, and it's bowling for dollars because it ran long. And as soon as bowling for friggin' dollars is done, the hatch blows on the Icarus and the astronauts. So you flash forward to about 1990. I'm in college. I go home for Christmas. Under the tree is a VHS copy of Planet of the Apes. My mom gives it to me. And that's, when affordable home VHS started coming out around the late 80s.
Sure.
So she gives me this copy of Planet of the Apes. I swear to you, Christmas 1990 is the first time I had ever seen the Heston in space.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Soliloquy at the start.
You're kidding me.
I am not kidding you.
Wow.
Yeah. That Christmas Eve, I probably got kind of drunk and watched it.
And yet at this point, at that same stage, do you have like a big collection of Apes merchandise?
I have a huge collection of Apes merchandise.
Wow.
I have all the TV movies on tape. I have the I have the animated series on tape. I've tracked that down. I just kind of worked backwards, but that was the first time I'd ever watched Planet of the Apes start to finish.
Interesting.
Yeah, and then I want to point out, too, that these movies, I've owned them on every, other than Beta.
Oh, my God.
I've had them on Laserdisc.
So the Apes movies for you are the equivalent of the James Bond movies for me.
Absolutely.
I've had them on VHS, on Laserdisc, on regular DVD, on Blu-ray DVD. I don't think there's.
I have the Ape movies on Blu-ray twice, because during a dark period there for a while, I started buying them, and then I couldn't find Conquest.
Mm.
And it's one of my favorites, and we'll get to that.
Conquest
in future
is the fourth.
Yeah, and I went out and just bought the set.
You know, that was
to get Conquest.
Why the logic from studio? I mean, it's not hard to figure out because they're always trying to cut corners and make money any which way they can, but the movies kept doing well, and the budget
kept cutting the
budget, so that it's so bad by the fourth or fifth one that there are extras in the group scenes.
Dude, the second one has that going on big.
They're wearing the extras are wearing like
just
licensed rubber Planet of the Apes masks that they haven't bothered to like darken in the eyes on the skin of the actor.
Yeah, the most glaring scene in all of the films happens in Beneath.
Uh huh.
Yeah, it's really bad.
What's the bit so people know what to look out
for? Well, General Aldo? No, not Aldo. General Ursus.
Right.
James Gregory gives a really
Ursus,
rousing.
Such a cool character.
Yeah, he really is. And James Gregory, amazing.
Wait. Is that the second one?
Yeah.
Okay, didn't Claude Akins play him?
He's Aldo.
And what,
Aldo's in the fifth
one. Which one is that?
That's Battle.
That's Battle. Okay, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah. So
James Gregory, of course, was the inspector from Barney Miller, and he was.
Hey, Ben. How you doing, Ben?
And McDonald from the Dean Martin, Matt Helm film.
And also, without giving too much away, a great character part in The Manchurian Candidate, the original Manchurian.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He also did a thing I remember, unless I'm completely mistaken. What's he called? What's his name?
James Gregory?
James Gregory.
Yeah.
There was
By the way, he was alive up until a couple of years ago.
No.
Yeah.
Was he?
Well, I remember on the Mego Museum, there was a kid who joined who was an Apes fan, and he was actually still writing to James Gregory. Oh, he died in 2002. Okay, so maybe I'm... But he was...
Still pretty recent, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was 90.
Well, he... And I'm looking it up right now, and I can't seem to find a connection, but I swear he was the voice on a record that I had as a kid where he was a dinosaur. He was like a brontosaurus. There was a kid on this record, in this story, and he became friends with this dinosaur, and he was I swear he was the dinosaur, but I think I might be wrong now because I'm just Googling James Gregory dinosaur. And I don't see any kind of connection.
You're getting some interesting slash fiction, I hope.
Yeah, exactly. Some real crazy fanfic.
Or a cool band name.
Yeah, James Gregory Dinosaur.
I always wanted to call my band Huge Beaumont.
I like that.
Yeah.
You got to be real careful with that one, though.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you really have to enunciate on that one.
Yeah.
I always thought a good one was Bananas Foster.
That's neat.
Or a name, good name for a child.
Well, yeah, your child.
Yeah, Bananas Foster. Okay, let's start heading toward the exits here.
Okay, well, I wanted to talk about the fact that this film was a huge success.
Yes.
Grossed over $30 million.
Wow.
It was, I think.
Wow.
I think it helped bail Fox out.
Probably.
Of a hole that they had, because I think they tried. They were doing some, I think all the major studios were in a bit of trouble at this time.
Well, let's do a quick 20-second background here on that, which we talked about a little bit in the Star Wars episode, and we could talk about any old time. This was at a time when the studios, speaking of dinosaurs, when the guys up at the top of the pyramid at the studios were older fellas. Completely and utterly out of touch with the youth market. It's exactly why something like Easy Rider took everybody by surprise, because the studio heads had no idea what was going on out there on the streets, and also studios were in trouble. They were backing old school projects and themes and things that might have worked 20 or 30 years before, but it was a musicals and things that,
yeah, like Hello Dolly.
Hello Dolly and Finian's Rainbow and shit like that that shouldn't have worked. And you've got this counterculture coming to the surface. Younger people are coming into the studios, and of course you had the whole auteur thing where it was the first generation of all these young filmmakers, the first generation to come out of film school, to be, you know, guys like John Ford and Michael Curtiz, like who knows who they were influenced by. They were setting the shit up from that moment on for all time. But you can look at guys like Scorsese and Coppola and Spielberg. They were studying all of those guys' movies, so you know, in film school and coming out of it. And you know, not to diminish any of their talent or anything, but Apes would be, you know, symbolic as something that slipped through the cracks that was very counterculture, because it really was. I mean, I truly think the more you see it, the further away you get from it, you realize just how subversive this thing was.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't your typical Hollywood studio picture at the time.
No, and. If anything, it's hard to step back from it and think, well, what was the message they were trying to say? Here's this guy that's criticizing man and the earth and what man has done to it. And, you know, it's an allegory for America and how wrong everybody's gotten it or whatever. Well, by the end, you know, are we supposed to come out of there and go, hey, you know, we shouldn't be bad mouthing it quite so much. It could be worse. Or, like, I don't know what the message or what we're supposed to sort of walk away with by the end of this thing. But it's a lot to swallow. It's a lot, you know, it really is. If no one's ever seen this thing, it's, I keep saying this, like, I think if you didn't know about this, if you've never seen this movie and all you knew of it were the toys and the cartoon and just the visuals of these apes, I think you would think that it was probably a slightly dated sci-fi kind of a romp that you know what I mean. If you were just to come to it fresh and if I showed you images you'd never seen it before, you'd probably look at those images and go, yeah, these look like guys in monkey makeup. It's really good, yeah. Really well done, but it looks like guys in monkey. But I don't think, having you know sat in front of it, that you would necessarily think it gets as bleak as it does. And it really is bleak and it's dark. And man, I can tell you exactly where I was. I can tell you the seat that I was sitting in, the day, the time of the showing, the day of the week, where I was when I sat in front of The Empire Strikes Back and the triple whammy of all the things that happened in that movie, from my hero, you know, Han Solo, what happens to him, to the big revelation. I can tell you exactly where I was. I don't remember exactly where I was the very first time I saw Apes and how that ending struck me, but I do remember it striking me. I do remember not having known about the twist, seeing it for the first time and going, oh man, you know, and having that reaction to it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a happy ending.
No, it isn't.
It's awesome, but, you know, but it's not a happy ending.
One of the things I really wanted to point out about this film, too, is if you got out of it as a kid and you liked it, there was very little merchandise.
That's right.
You know, I think you may have gotten some ape covers on magazines, and there was a trading card set. But
was there
one
like
of the one of yeah, there was. I used to have it. One of the reasons there was no merchandise is actually related to Planet of the Apes. In 1967, Arthur P. Jacobs created or booked a film called Dr. Doolittle.
And oh yeah, that's a perfect example of what we were just talking.
Yeah, they spent $17 million on this thing.
Yep,
and it grossed $9 million.
Yep,
and at the time, Apjack sold the license to like Mattel and,
yeah,
and Remco, and there was, you know, Aurora did a push me pull you model. And that stuff stunk up the toy shelves.
Just,
it was a huge bomb.
You can't give it away today. Wasn't
yeah.
there a well? There was the push me pull you. There was a what was the big snail thing?
You know what? I've never seen the whole thing.
Oh, it's a big steaming pile of crap.
I was a kid. I tried to watch it. I remember going, uh-huh.
You know what's great about it? It's more fascinating than the movie itself. Are the behind the scenes stories?
Oh, really?
And also of Rex Harrison, who's supposed to be one of the most gigantic assholes in the
history. You know what? I was going to say, anytime anything I've ever heard about Rex Harrison, he's a dick. There's a local place here. There's a local business here called Honest Ed's. We drove by it. The Mervish family have brought a lot of theater to Toronto.
Right.
They've been a wonderful artistic influence. And Honest Ed, the owner, Ed Mervish, he was a really nice man. He didn't speak ill of many people, except Rex Harrison. He did not like Rex Harrison.
He was a giant drunk.
Yeah.
And Doolittle was such a mess, but he was just supposed to be insufferable. Just got off.
Yeah.
There's a giant snail. There's a giant pink snail. I think they made a toy of that.
I know they made Dr. Doolittle doll.
And they made a figure. Didn't Mattel do like Amigo type figure?
It's not quite Amigo. Yeah, it's like a little 6-inch bendy figure.
Right.
The thing I was trying to, it wasn't until Apes, they were all gun shy. toy companies and licensors to license movies after that. You know, you might get a model kit or you might get a Halloween costume, but it wasn't until the runaway success with Apes.
Well, now things
74.
Okay, so you need to and we can get to this more in detail in the next episode,
sure.
But you can open the door a crack for the eager listener to get to the next, you know, to part two. With Star Trek, you know, people forget, especially now in light of, I just was looking at something at the newsstand, actually, a special edition TV Guide sort of magazine tribute to Leonard Nimoy. And it's beautiful. I mean, the pictures, the behind the scenes stuff, you know, it's just really cool. And, you know, you realize how he really was a cornerstone of television as a television character, and you know this was a big deal. You know his passing, but there's some great pictures outside the studio of people. I think it was like shots of people protesting the cancellation or that was on the bubble or something. You know, everyone knows that the fans kind of got that third season. But you know, people forget that it did have a following while it was on. It was not, you know, it was not a disaster. It was not just because it failed. It was not a failure of a show. It had a following, you know, while it was on. But it gets canceled in 69. It goes into syndication early 70s. But it's popular enough. You got to do the math here. It's popular enough in syndication. This is what blows my head off. The animated series was 1973. To get that into production had to be 72. So you're telling me from 69 to 72, by 1972, they were already seeing numbers and results of syndication, how popular the show was, that it was enough for Filmation to go, let's do an animated series?
Kids were watching it.
Okay, so the numbers are coming in, and at that
point, numbers were different by that point.
Right, but by that point, so you're talking 72, everybody starts to take notice of just how well this thing is doing.
It's famously known that Star Trek, had they 1 year later, they started doing demographics,
right,
like what age group are watching the show.
Right.
It's famously known that if they had just lasted, hung on, they would have probably been renewed because
the
unbelievable amount of young people watching.
The show would still be on the air probably.
Yeah.
So 72, you know, when the show's on the air, there are some Rack toys, there's some crazy Remco stuff, but there's nothing that is like a 1:1 depiction of the Enterprise or a phaser or anything.
I think there was a model of the Enterprise. I think Aurora.
Aurora might have done, yeah. So other than that, it's just kind of willy-nilly. Nobody really cares. By 72, all the major, you know, licensors are suddenly noticing that this thing is doing something. And so that's when the feelers start to go out for merchandise. And as everyone knows, you know, by 74, 75, 76, I just bid on a crazy British Punch Out and Make It / coloring book that's mental. It's completely mental. It's got on the front cover Sulu in a light blue tunic, but on the inside, his Punch Out character, the name on the base is Sal.
Oh, Sal.
Like Sal's famous pizza.
Salvatore, yeah.
It's mental, but that was like 75, 76. Stuff would still be made. So what year... when was it? The Apes comes out in 69. I don't know the dates off the top of my head of the next, of the subsequent, you know, films, but when sort of was the year zero that Mego or whomever starts to go, hey, this has a, was it when it started to air on television? Like
when the movie aired on TV, I think in the 73, and it was like, it got these Wizard of Oz type numbers. Mm. Also, I think one of the first people on the bandwagon for Planet of the Apes was Adar, which was a model kit company run by some former Aurora people. And
oh, yeah.
you couldn't. One of the former guys at MeeGo I knew, Vinny Baiera, he told me that, you know, the reason MeeGo did the Planet of the Apes line was because he walked into a hobby shop in Brooklyn and the guy said, "I can't keep these things on the shelves."
Wow.
And Baiera bought them all, and he was a huge fan of the films himself, and you know, Abrams' kid was all about apes too. So I'd love to get into that in a much more longer.
The Blitz
burned very brightly, but not for a long time, because it was in between Battle of the Planet of the Apes and the announcement of the CBS TV series. Everything was Ape Mania. The CBS TV series gets canceled, and it's, you know, once something is out of the, you know, like, out of sight, out of mind.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of fizzled, and we all went on to Evel Knievel and
oh, interesting.
Yeah, superheroes and whatever else.
But the stuff. The brilliant thing about this is you can really speak to this. Not just the MeeGo stuff. You know, the really well known stuff like the MeeGo stuff, but all the Rack toys, right?
Oh yeah, there there was. We'll get into it in the next one a bit. There were, I'd say, 10 different companies making, you know, cheap Planet of the Apes toys, and then there was
stuff.
Four or five different companies. None of, you know, it depended on the company. Like a company like AHI was making stuff that you could, it was a sculpted, you know, ape on a horse, and then you just had Laramie selling a frisbee that didn't say Planet of the Apes when you took it off the card, you know.
Right. No, it was a wide breadth of stuff, but it's a lot of stuff. Everything from like super balls to, you know, figural.
I tried going down that road a couple of times, and it's really, I really have to hone it, because like I've had Planet of the Apes puncho balls, you know, when you had the big inflatable ball.
Mm-hmm.
And different items. it's endless,
I love the little figural, the squirt guns that are the big.
Oh yeah, the heads. Yeah,
because they did them for Universal Monsters. They did them for, you know, DC and Marvel. Super.
Yeah, those two different companies that did it, but
right? Aren't those, like, one of your favorite goofy things?
Yeah, I have my Frankenstein squirt gun is one of my favorites. I'm 44 years old. I've been collecting since I was 14. I still sometimes, you know, look around at Planet of the Apes stuff and go, either I've forgotten this item existed or I have never seen this before. So
wow, that's cool though. That's really cool. But I love, because the apes, and we got, because this is an entire episode that we could just be talking about the merchandise. A couple of the things that the great thing about the ape stuff, to me, more so than just about any of, I mean, there's goofiness to, you know, a Hulk parachute figure or a Captain Kirk parachute, you know, whatever, or a Superman parachute figure, but the ape stuff goes from completely logical to off its tits mental.
It's sublimely ridiculous.
Sublimely ridiculous. So. And the two that would come to mind immediately would be the you know, anything that's an ape on horseback, you go, well, that did happen. That was, we did get that.
But an ape on Harley Davidson.
Ape on Harley Davidson. But my favorite, and I don't even collect the ape stuff, but one day I'd love to have one of these just to have, is the little helicopter.
Hanging on my wall.
Because it's got that brilliant font is the wrong word, but you know the apes writing, whatever.
Yeah, the hieroglyphics.
The hieroglyphics.
I believe it says Planet of the Apes because, you know, they like stating where they were from, and yeah, it's even got a little sculpted
and a little sculpted monkey in the pilot seat, which is brilliant because I've got one,
and then of course the TV series, the cartoon had helicopters. So
that's right, and I had I've got one. You know, there's that weirdness in the '70s of the Shadow, where there was, but each of these little rack things, when it came to the helicopter, they went so far as to, whether it was a little Batman or a little monkey or whatever, to sculpt the little pilot. I love that little detail. But that's the ape stuff goes from, you know, makes perfect sense to madness, and it's so much fun to talk about.
And we should get into that in episode 2, which will be coming soon.
Next
week. But next week, you've bitten off too much, sir. But for that, I think we should leave it there. And
that's great. I think we pretty much covered the first. I mean, like I said, it's so rich. There's so much to it. But yeah. Just covering that first movie, I think, that's a good way to just start, and that's it.
We're maniacs. We blew it up.
We blew it up! Good stuff. I knew this wouldn't be a problem.
No, this one was easy. Yeah. Just so everybody knows, we did not prep for this one.
Nope, not at all. And my edict was, you get it started, Hyler, and I'll try to keep up.
we'll prep for the next ones, yeah, I promise.
Didn't seem to be a problem. All right, cool. We'll say good night to everyone, and then stay on the line because you and I need to talk about something in between the commercial break.
All righty, then.
Thanks,
take care, everybody.